Software Engineering Radio, Episode 37, Extreme Programming, Part 1.
Hi, everybody. Great to have you all listening in once again. Today, it's Alex and Arno talking about extreme programming. Alex, this was actually your idea, so I suggest you just dig right into things.
Yes, the idea of doing an extreme programming episode and the development process episodes first is because XP has, well, there's a lot of buzz around XP, actually, and it's in my opinion, kind of the very minimal development process we have. So it's a good starting point to see what we have and have a process where you actually can't take anything out of the process without getting into trouble. So it's a good starting point, in my opinion.
I think this is quite an interesting claim. I think we'll need to take a closer look at that later,
yeah,
because it's a strong claim that we cannot take anything out. But yeah, I agree, and we'll get into that when we're looking at the practices and the details.
Yeah, we should. Nevertheless, extreme programming is, well, huge is maybe the wrong word, but there's a lot of things we should talk about. So I guess we will have two episodes covering XP. The first one doing the principles and all the basic stuffs, and actually the practices, which are the heart of extreme programming. I guess we will do the big picture stuff and how all the practices relate together and how are the process stuff and all this in the second episode. So let's start. As is already said, XP's had some started some hype, I would say, the agile movement. So it's a very it's a hot topic. There are really fans of XP and guys who don't like it at all. So there's a lot of emotion in XP. We try to stay on the fact side, I hope, at least.
Yeah, have you ever actually worked with Kent Beck? Have you have life experience with him?
No, unfortunately not.
I once have the privilege of doing pair programming with him.
Ooh.
And he is a guy who can really polarize people. I mean, at one point he actually yanked away the keyboard from me, slapped me on the hands and said, "Test first!"
Okay.
Much of these emotional aspects of extreme programming go back to Kent Beck, and I mean, the word extreme programming sort of supports the hype aspect, which I think is great because it helped the agile movement in getting coverage. But then again, it was started to be a problem at one point in time because, it sort of, it had the taste of it's not really to be taken serious. It's not for serious programming, which I think is bad because agile development and extreme programming do work in commercial and good projects.
Yeah, exactly. But as you said, I still think it was one of the greatest ideas to call it extreme programming. I don't think we would have the agile movement where we have it right now without such a, emotional name. So it's not just another development process. It's something special from the name, from the beginning. So. It helped a lot, I guess.
Yeah.
So, what is XP? Well, first of all, it's an incremental and iterative development process. We talked a lot of about these words and what they mean in the first development process overview episode. So go back there and listen to what it means if you don't or if you are not comfortable with both of the words. Was invented in the late 90s by Kent Beck and Ward Cunningham and Ron Jeffries.
To the CCC project now, the Chrysler Comprehensive Compensation, is that what you're referring to?
Exactly. At least that's what I heard was the first real extreme programming project. Nevertheless, the three say they used a lot of the practices of XP in earlier projects too, and actually a lot of the stuff you find in the Smalltalk community. So the name extreme programming and the whole concept as one development process goes back there, but the core is older.
Yeah, this is the story that I heard is that of course many of the practices go far back beyond that project, And at the beginning of the project, XP did not exist, and sort of the process gelled, became an explicit process in the course of this project.
Yeah. And nevertheless, still XP is, I wouldn't say rapidly changing, but it's changing, and we will get into trouble in our two episodes, too, with this topic, because there are two editions of the basic extreme programming book from Kent Beck, and actually the it's called Extreme Programming Explained, Embrace Change. We will do a link to our site.
In the notes, on this.
Yeah. And the second edition actually is very, very different to the first edition. It's nearly a complete rewrite. We have some trouble in to decide which version of XP we really discussed. and I guess we will, go into details on some of the topics we will discuss.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is sort of funny because especially in the beginning, during the first years, extreme programming people were really, very strict about you need to do exactly this, otherwise you cannot call it extreme programming.
Yeah.
But things sort of mellowed out, and I think it's very important that it actually evolved and the discussion got beyond this.
You need
to do everything exactly by the book. Stage.
That's right, but nevertheless, I would also recommend to start with an exact XP copy. Whether version 1 or 2 doesn't matter so much, but we will get into this. Some of the practices of XP are, they can do harm if you don't do another practice, which actually gives some synergetics between the two practices. So it's a good idea to start with a whole set. Whether version 1 or version 2 doesn't matter so much to me, actually.
Yeah. What I suggest we just sort of dig in. I think the heart of XP are the values behind extreme programming. At least that's what Kent Beck says in the book, and I think that works quite well.
Yeah.
What are those values?
Maybe we should explain what values are for Kent Beck, and he defined it. They are universal, they are complementary, they are consistent and purposeful. So
what does that mean?
Who knows?
I think what he's trying to get at is that they are sort of have an objective side to them. They're not a matter of taste, but the idea is that they go beyond personal taste, that the team needs to have these values consistently in order to achieve a purpose, and that they're sort of universal, like every team that should have them, at least every good working team, and they are the basis that everything else builds on.
Exactly, and they are, I would call it a system of values. The idea is that they complement each other. So, if you change out one of the values, actually, you have or you can get into trouble. So, always take these values as a complete system of values.
Well, actually, I think it goes beyond that, because values are not something that you sort of pick up for a project and then dump for the next.
Yeah.
I think this is at a personal level. I think the idea is that the core team needs to actually have these values as part of their personalities. And then the idea is that others also change deep inside at a personality level to actually take these things as values of their own, not just for the professional side during the project.
Absolutely. And, so it's a first litmus test if you can deal with extreme programming, I would say, because not every company I know will get warm with all the values of XP, actually. So I would recommend to check out the values. And as you said, it's a personal thing. If you don't feel comfortable with all these values, maybe XP isn't the best thing for you to start with.
Okay, let's dig in. What are those values?
Yes, maybe I list them first up, and then we can discuss a bit of them. So to get this system feeling a bit. They are communication, simplicity, feedback, courage, and respect. So if you take these values actually and look at the Agile Manifesto, you see they fit very well together. So you see the familiarity of these ideas, the communication thing, the simplicity thing, do only the simplest thing that could possibly work, which is a strong sentence and highly discussed sentence, because do the simplest thing that could possibly work doesn't mean do the simplest thing, actually. And a lot of people get this sentence wrong and say, oh, the simplest thing doesn't work for me. You shouldn't do it.
Yeah, so, right. Exactly. Like documentation. Agile is not don't do any documentation, just discard the documentation you don't need.
Yeah, absolutely. An important thing here, to me, personally to me, is the courage thing. I guess at least, well, I my first XP project, is a long time ago, and, actually, XP was very, well, not so famous at this time, and it actually takes courage to do it right that, because a lot of the practices are contrary to the, beliefs and the stuff you learn at your university, how to do things. I guess courage is a huge point for doing XP. Not so much today, maybe, but, in some companies still, I would say.
Right, exactly. Courage sort of, takes you by surprise when you first hear it. To say courage is an important part of developing software.
Yeah.
But I agree, it's a very important thing, and the credits go to Extreme Programming for making that explicit.
Yeah, maybe we should give some examples. I mean, actually, it takes courage to do such little documentation, to don't think contract-based with your customer, to get a team feeling with your customer and share the risk with them, which is contrary to a lot of business belief, actually, where you try to fix everything in a contract, and afterwards, if something goes wrong, you know at least who's the one who did the wrong thing, so... everything a bit different to a lot of cultural stuff in the business world.
And also at the technical level, it does take courage to say, hey, I think we went into an entirely wrong direction for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. We need to throw away what we did and start over.
Absolutely.
That's the sort of thing.
Yeah. One of the values is feedback, and as we taught very, very much in the first development process episode, I wouldn't go into detail here, but the feedback stuff is well, very, very important to iterative and incremental development. And feedback is necessary for gaining knowledge, for changing requirements. It's simply the core for the empiric process stuff, just to get the link back.
Right. I think it is actually the role of the project manager in XP to provide feedback, to do measurements, to provide feedback, to guide the team by providing feedback, and not by making the decision herself, but by confronting the team with the consequences of alternatives.
Exactly.
Which also sort of goes back to the courage thing, because leading in that way does take courage.
Yeah, I was very astounded when I first, or when I did my first XP, real XP project, how much you do with, measurement, actually. I mean, most of the projects I did before were, well, you do your software, you do it, as good as you can, and when it's done, it's done. But you do, you collect a lot of numbers while doing XP, and you calculate your speed, your development speed, and calculate how much of your feature set you will be able to do until a special time point. So it's very, very different on this point.
Yeah, exactly. But I think we should sort of try getting to what XP actually looks like. I think we've got the mindset that is behind, that is the basis for things. You need to value communication. You need to value simplicity. And you need to value feedback, actually confront yourself with whether a decision was successful or not.
Yep.
You need to have courage to change the direction, and you need to respect one another. So where do we go once we have these values?
Well, the values are the very, very basics of XP, and they have still, well, I don't know how to call it, abstract thing above the values, but these are more concrete than the values already. They are called the principles. And principles are actually, the definition says they are widely applicable. They are domain specific, whatever that means. I mean, we get a bit into this when we see some of them. They can be contradictory, in contrast to the values, which shouldn't. And they should be concrete enough to guide your behavior. And one thing, and we already touched it before, is strangely enough, they changed from the first book to the second book nearly completely. So I'm maybe we should look into the ones from the first book first and then touch the ones from the second edition just to get a full picture. But you will see all of them for first or second book will fit to the same values. So that it's it's really fits the definition. So
the idea is sort of to break down the values into more hands on more detailed things
to guide behavior. I said yes.
Yeah,
actually. So in the first book, there actually were five basic principles. First one is rapid feedback, which well easily maps to the value, of course. Then assume simplicity,
increment maps to a value.
Yeah, exactly. Incremental change, which is interesting. Embracing change, also very, very interesting. And the book itself, it's called Embrace Change. So very strong for XP and quality work. So what touches me actually is the quality work thing, because it's... I think a lot of developers do want to do quality work, and XP is very much on their side. It's very developer-centric on this point, because it says you have to do quality work to keep your speed, to make it work, to do non-trivial software, and quality actually is not an option in XP. Very, very interesting thing. I never read this in another development process that strongly.
Yeah, I mean, also, XP is sort of one of the strictest processes.
Yeah.
It requires developers to sort of submit themselves to a common goal to achieve this quality and be, and yeah, this is, I think quality is really at the heart of extreme programming.
Yeah. We will see this in the practices too, as, I mean, it started the unit testing movement, which already swept over the whole development world. Not only the XP guys do unit testing anymore, so, it made this movement famous or great. Embrace change, very important thing. In my opinion, XP was built to fit in environments where you have changing requirements, maybe even fast changing requirements. So you have to deal with the fact that requirements change. That's actually a huge difference to some of the other development processes where you try to fix the requirements as good as you can. And XP says, regardless how much work you put into this, we try to fix the requirements, they will change. That's a matter of fact. And
I think we'll go into that in more detail in the second episode, where we look at the context of extreme programming, the business, and overall picture.
Good idea. And of course, incremental change, to deal with changing requirements, you have to be able to do incremental change to your software, actually. So these were the basic principles from the first book. Should we discuss the well, smaller ones also from the first?
I can go into them when we're looking at the practices, because they are reflected in the practices.
Good idea, yes. In the second book, there actually is a complete or a huge set of principles there. And I don't think we should really dig into deep.
Into them. I mean, we'll look at those principles as well. When we're looking at the practices, they'll pop up one again and again.
Exactly. Nevertheless, maybe I should give a short overrun over them to give an idea how they look like. I mean, they're still based on the same value system. So the principles in the second edition of XP, the newer one, are humanity, economics, mutual benefit, self-similarity, improvement, diversity, reflection, flow, opportunity, redundancy, failure, quality, baby steps. We will touch all of these ideas actually when we discuss the practices. So yes, as you said, we shouldn't go deep in there right now.
Right, but before we go to the practices, there's one little story I'd like to tell. Kent said once that he asked people after an extreme programming project what was most important to them, what for them was the best part of doing extreme programming. And he expected people to give technical things like, we did quality work or that sort of thing, or we met our budget constraints. But what people said was, when Harry's wife got sick, he could just leave out for a couple of days and stay with her. And that sort of things outside the actual work is really part of the XP culture.
Yep.
Extreme programming is not just about getting a job done, but it's about values, about things that touch the life outside. The idea is that programmers, developers, every member of the team is not just replaceable, is not just a number, but is valuable. And these things are really, really important. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind before we dig into the practices, because the practices are about mostly about getting the job done, but the other things are the basis for these principles, for these practices that actually build on the values.
Yeah, absolutely. Humans are not resources that can be easily exchanged as some other processes assume. Yeah.
Okay, so what are the practices? Now it's becoming juicy, because this is actually the thing that is most prominently known about extreme programming.
Okay. For the practices, same problem a bit, different editions of XP. This time we'll stay with a second edition. We have a complete list here, so we should go into the details with them, because they are more newer ones.
Okay, I suggest we first go through them one by one, and then we look at how they interact.
Okay, yes, fine. First one, sit together. Well, all of the, maybe we should say first, every practice has a name, so sit together is the name of the first practice, actually. So, sit together, well, the idea is easy. Make it easy to communicate between the people. You remember the values. So put all the people, if possible, into one room. Communication is essential for development, and the cost of communication should be low. And therefore, the easiest thing is to put them in a one room, of course.
Which is quite a controversial practice, especially among developers. I mean, put 10 developers into a team, into a single room, and usually the noise level will go up so far, and the joking will be so loud that nobody can actually get much work done, because everyone keeps everyone else from working. So this requires discipline on the part of the developers to sort of respect the others, take back themselves to enable the others. This is sort of a prerequisite which goes back to the values, that is a prerequisite for actually having the whole team in one room.
Exactly. And put it another way, this is one of the practices that doesn't make much sense if you don't do some of the other practices as well. I mean, if you take your team, put it in one room, and still you have a team that isn't a team, actually, team 10 people who work for each other with no communication, you just raise the noise level. You have no of the positive benefits. So sitting together, of course, just makes sense when the people really work together. So you have to do pair programming and all this stuff to make it purposeful and sensible,
Maybe you should mention that having people in one room means really one room. No cubicle walls or something.
Yeah.
One big open space with people sitting at desks all over the place with easy access from one to the other. So this is really about not having any private part for any single developer.
Yeah.
So this is really being together in it. This is an expression of we're in it together, and there's no such thing as I win, you lose. Either we win together or we lose together.
Yeah, and actually, because it is, I mean, you could imagine that is hard if you have no privacy anymore. That's why they recommend you to make some rooms free in your building where you can do your email stuff alone, or where you can do private stuff. So, you have to find room for this.
Exactly. This is not about removing all privacy. It's just that in the workspace, privacy is not the primary concern, but the togetherness is the primary concern.
When you do teamwork, do it best. I mean, this is one of that's why it's called extreme programming, because they took all the best practices, so-called best practices, and maximized them out. They put all the knobs on 10, like Kent Beck.
Right.
Calls it.
That's what he likes to say in the marketing talks.
Yeah.
Okay. But that brings us to the second practice, I think. Having the whole team together.
Yeah. Which doesn't mean your team shouldn't be separated by the functions of your teams. Put all your people together. Do the requirement engineers and whatever you have, put them all in one room. Let them work cross-functional together. So,
there are no requirements engineers, right?
Yeah, but there are on-site customers, maybe testers, whoever works in your team. So the classic requirement engineers aren't there, but, you have the job to do. So you do your user stories and stuff like that. And, separating people out to do user stories and only user stories and put them in an extra room and put your on-site customer in an extra room. Bad idea. Not the idea of XP, of course. Mm-hmm.
So the project manager and everybody sits together in this single big room with no cubicle partitions.
Exactly.
Sort of taking the open door policy to the extreme.
Yeah. And of course, you could imagine that doesn't work too good for a 200 person team. So,
200 person never is a team.
Yeah. But, nevertheless, I guess we have to say it, at some point. At least in the first book, there was a limit set up to 10 or 12 people, where XP works best.
Right.
Actually, in the second book is a bit softer with this limit, as we already have, huge teams doing XP. They do it, of course, not in the uncustomized way. They build clusters, sub teams, whatever. Second edition says, okay, you can also do large projects, huge projects with XP, but first edition and all the primary practice the idea is to work in a small team.
Right. I mean, it is definitely possible to do agile development with really huge projects. And I see a trend from the first book to the second book. The first book was very clear. XP means having these practices with an actual team size of 10 or 12 people max. And the second book sort of wanted to expand the scope and sort of softened the definition of extreme programming to include other kinds, a bigger variety of agile development. Agile development is definitely possible for any size of project, and extreme programming, I think we are safe to say extreme programming is best fit for actually one team that can sit together in one room.
Yeah. And actually that's what I like a lot about the first edition of the book. It was very clear about when to use it, when not to use.
Okay. So, let's look at the third practice, which is about how to organize the workspace.
Mm-hmm. Well, simple idea. Use your workspace. I mean, you have walls in there. You have desks in there. Just use it. Use post-its, to put or white papers, put them on your wall, stick them on the wall. So, use the space you have best for your work. Very easy idea. Nevertheless, some of the companies, have very strict, regulation on how to use your office space.
Right.
Kind of stupid.
Actually, someone once told me that when he came into a company, I'm not going to name the company now, they wanted to do extreme programming, but they had big office with cubicle walls. So they sort of one morning before everyone else arrived, they brought power tools from home and took down the cubicle walls to maximize the use of their workspace.
What happened to the team?
They got away with it. They got away with it.
Great.
So yeah, this is sort of the spirit that this rebel spirit. We are together. We are one team. We are well gelled, and we are together. And the rest of the company is not. This sort of thing tends to happen with extreme programming, I think.
Courage again.
And again, the idea is we want to work as good as we can. So we're going to do whatever it takes to work well and make use of anything we can. If the walls are in the way of our team communication, we'll take them out. And if we need whiteboards, we'll put them up. That sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, when you said this, I remember one of the ideas of XP is you have to play to win if you want to do XP, not play to play, or play not to lose. You have to play to win, actually. It's a different idea how to do your project. So,
which is again an interesting thing that we'll look at in the second episode, I think, because winning can mean different things to different people.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, we'd better leave that for the big picture in the second episode.
Okay. Next thing, energized work. I guess it was called 40 hours week earlier. I'm not sure. But that what's the idea, the basic idea is in between. In IT, a lot of teams work very long hours, and actually you have you can have to know your limits, and it doesn't matter if it's actually 40 hours or 44 hours or 38 hours. That's not the point here. And the point is, work as much or as little, to stay focused, to have energy enough to work on the next day with the same energy level. And, you don't work for sprint, intervals, but for long distance runs.
Go at a sustainable pace.
Yeah, exactly.
Which also means, I mean, there's another side to this coin, which means, don't pressurize people to spend many hours at the office, but also make good use of the hours that you actually are at work.
Yeah.
Many of the practices like pair programming, especially, or being in one office room tends to help focus on actually working.
Yeah. And you're so right. The first weeks, I remember when I did pair programming, I couldn't do any after hours. It's hard to do, actually. It's exhausting. Yeah.
You can actually be disciplined about taking time off between programming in order to re-energize. You cannot do that 8 hours on end. But this brings us to the next practice, pair programming, actually.
Oh, that's a hard
one. What is pair programming?
The idea is two developers, one keyboard. Again, best practice for this is code review, and it's done to the extreme, but it has more benefits than just code reviews. The idea actually is that two developers code each non-trivial part of code together. You always have a peer who looks what you do, if you do it right, and actually the error level goes so much lower than you ever could believe it will do. The design will get better, and even naming stuff and a lot of sloppiness goes away with this. But it is exhausting. It's not for everyone, actually. And it's a hot topic. A lot of people don't like it. But actually, I have to say, most of the people who don't like it didn't really try it out for a longer period of time. So,
on the other hand, is a little unfair, because if people try it out for 2 or 3 days and they hate it and go at each other's throats, I mean,
it's
sort of unfair to say you didn't like it, you should have tried it for another week.
Well, the point nevertheless is it sounds awful, actually. I mean, the first time I heard it and someone did want to do it with me for real project work, not hobby programming. I was I didn't feel very comfortable with the idea having someone sitting besides me and looking at every thing I do the whole day. So, it sounds very, very bad. And, actually it isn't that bad. At least not as bad as it sounds. Maybe we should discuss the practical stuff before we discuss the people stuff
exactly.
On this one.
Yeah.
Actually, pair programming doesn't mean you get your friend and let them sit beside you for the whole day, and he doesn't do anything besides staring at your screen. You have to change the peers, and you have to change it often. Actually, the time period is from 5 minutes to a few hours, and after a few hours, you should really change the peering.
I think there are two things that change over time. One is you're not working together with the same person all the time, but you switch the teammate with who you sit before the keyboard, which means one day you sit with Alex.
Exactly.
Next in the afternoon you sit with Mary, and on the third day you sit with Ben. So it's really, you change the people. There are no fixed pairs.
Exactly.
But the other thing that changes is the roles change. I mean, if you're sitting, yep. Obviously it's not, doesn't work very well if two people type on the same keyboard at the same time.
So one the mouse and one the keyboard.
it doesn't really work well if one has the mouse, the other the keyboard. So obviously there are two roles. One person actually does the typing. The other is sort of looking and reviewing and commenting.
Yep.
Well, the person who is typing often tends to report in a low voice, so not to disturb others, but still both sort of discuss things. They're doing it all the time. But the important thing is to change the keyboard actually every couple of minutes.
Yeah.
There are situations when it makes sense to for one person to keep the keyboard longer than that. But actually, if I'm typing and Alex has a good idea to do things differently, I shove the keyboard so he implements his idea.
Mm-hmm.
And this changing is one of the hardest things of pair programming and actually of extreme programming, I think. The idea is to have ego-less programming. There's no such thing as code ownership.
Yep.
If I code something, it does not belong to me. But the idea is quite the contrary. If I have a great design idea, the best thing that can happen from an XP point of view is that someone else implements it and all the team is able to change it later because everyone understood it. So this is pair programming. Together, and the idea is to get the job done, to get good software done, not to play to play, not to have fun. I mean, it is fun, but the idea is not fun for its own sake, but to program as effectively as possible. And for that, it's a good idea to share the design, to share the code in the whole team. We'll get to testing later on, test first, which is a good prerequisite for that. But one more thing.
Necessary, I would say, even.
Definitely necessary, yeah. So these practices go together, but still, the idea here is no one owns code. So there are code conventions that everyone shares, so everyone feels at home with all the code. And if I have a job I want to get done, let's say Alex designed the reporting subsystem, and I want to fix a bug that affects the reporting subsystem, then the obvious thing to do is for me to approach Alex and say, Alex, I'd like to code together with you. When do you have time? I need to get a job done on the reporting subsystem, and you know that better than me. So we sit together and work on that. So it's a very natural way of transferring knowledge. In many projects, I would just approach him and say, there's a bug. Please fix this in the reporting subsystem and tell me when you're finished.
Or even worse, you call your project manager to get anyone to fix it. I mean,
right, exactly.
It's not really. I mean, we're used to it already, but it's not so common in business world that one developer gets another one and they fix it together. Actually,
exactly. Depends on the team culture and the size and things.
Yeah.
But here's the idea: is actually for that. The goal that everyone's driving it is that all the people are familiar with all the code so that anyone can change and fix anything.
Yeah.
And since that is often not entirely the case, it's an established best practice if you want to work on code that you are not absolutely familiar with, that you don't feel comfortable changing, you could just get someone who knows the code better, and then you will learn about the code and feel more comfortable working on it the next time. And this really requires a value system of communication, of getting the job done, of respect for one another.
Yeah.
And in my experience, this is the single biggest hindrance, the biggest single obstacle in implementing extreme programming. There's a culture of cowboy programming. It is cool to be the tough guy, this is my code, hands off. Who changed my design? I did such a great job and you messed it all up, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there's just no room for that in extreme programming.
Much ego.
So this is egoless programming. The idea is the team gets the job done, and this is not about hedging off, staking your claims inside the project. There's no room for that in extreme programming. People either give up this sort of staking their claims, or they won't fit into an NXP team.
You sound very emotional with this one, so.
Yeah, well, actually, there was a project I worked, I was actually project lead, and I tried to implement extreme programming. It started very carefully. Yeah. So I paired up a good friend of mine with someone else. Actually, we discussed it, and everyone thought, okay, we'll give it a try. And they sort of went at each other's throats.
Because
they were both, they had both very strong egos.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I'm speaking from experience here. Yeah. It does have an impact on your, on the values, on the private values of every single person working on the project.
Yeah, really. I have to agree completely. Pair programming is really, it's really a hard thing to do. Don't underestimate it here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's then one of the major points where XP fails, or the introduction of an extreme programming into a team fails very often.
Mm-hmm.
Or a team doesn't, well, it's not the right team for extreme programming.
To end on a positive note, if you actually do implement pair programming and it does work,
yeah,
it is such a great experience. It brings you together with the team. It creates so much trust, such a feeling of we are together, we can do anything. Such a feeling of or such respect for one another. Like, everyone knows the strengths and weaknesses of other people, so there's nothing to hide from one another.
You learn a lot from each other.
You learn from one another, and you also, I mean, there's much less pressure on single members of the team, especially in tough phases of the project. I mean, we all know the sort of thing, and a big deadline is approaching, and I designed the database access layer and implemented it. So if there's a problem with the database access layer, I'll be the one working through the nights because no one else can. That sort of thing. Or also finger pointing and blaming. You made that mistake. Just happens a lot less. So it's a really, really rewarding experience to work in pairs. It just means that you have to adapt sort of deep down within for it to work.
I agree completely, and pair programming is one of the it's great. It's and there are the social benefits you already mentioned. There are the hard facts, of course. You have a lot less bugs in your code. You have, as management or customer, you don't have the problem that only one guy can do fix your bug or whatever. So
that's a truck factor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The truck factor. Might you explain truck factor?
Okay, truck factor means how many people need to get run over by a truck for the program, for the project to fail. Sort of, how many people share important knowledge, or how centralized is important knowledge in the heads of one person alone. So truck factor of one means, I'm the only one who can do something. So if I'm run over by a truck, the project will stop and fail.
Yeah, exactly. But playing the, I also would say pair programming is great. it's simply great.
Absolutely.
But playing devil's advocate here, you have the problem. You have to explain management, that two guys doing the job for one. How would you react to this? I mean, two developers, one keyboard. You could get the idea. You only have half the productivity.
Yeah, but I think this is an important thing in introducing this, and I think we should look at that both at the management level and the team level. Let's start with the management level, which you just addressed. I think the key thing here is quality of the software, and actually that is what extreme programming is about.
Mm-hmm.
Having software that has a continuously high level of quality, so that the pace. I mean, if the inside quality is reduced, if the code goes bad, if the software design tends towards chaos, the productivity goes down, at least in the final days before a deadline, before delivery, because it's very, very, there are bugs and they're very difficult to fix. And if you fix one bug, problems pop up in seemingly unrelated places, that sort of thing. So many of the practices of extreme programming, and especially pair programming and test-driven development, are focused on spending effort in the beginning in order to maintain a high level of quality and reduce risk.
Mm.
So those are, I think, terms that management is able to understand.
Yeah.
I mean, if they actually do value quality, there's an amazing number of managers who either don't value quality or who have heard so many promises about quality that they actually don't believe you.
But the important point here is actually that the quality is not for its own sake. As you said, the idea, even in XP, the idea is have quality to keep speed up. That's that's the point. You have to do incremental change, and you can only do incremental change and architecture and all this stuff on the way or by the by doing the project by changing requirements if your quality is up. You don't have any chance to do it otherwise. So quality is not a nice to have factor to have happy customers. How some could take a look at quality. It's essential. It doesn't work without actually.
Yeah, very very important point.
Yeah,
but now let's look at
One or do you have other points for the management or whatever view on pair programming? Because I want to give one last or from my side last comment on how to introduce pair programming. Because one of the major points done wrong when introducing pair programming is not leaving space and or spare time and places for people to relax and calm down.
You mean at the team level now? Let's sort of say the management gave their okay, you may do pair programming. How do you actually win a team and introduce pair programming into the team so the team actually digs in and does it and likes it?
Exactly. So
How do you do that?
Well, first of all, it's always great to have someone in your team who already did it. Nothing can compare to that. So try to get someone who does know how to do it. But
and
that's
if you don't have anyone like that, sort of try to do it yourself. Ask people to join you at your table, at your desk, and sort of share the keyboard with them so as to gain the experience yourself.
Exactly. Second point is start slow. Don't start with 8 hours a day pair programming. Do it 1 hour a day in the first 2-3 days, then 2 hours. And so get up, to the, maximum level that actually fits your power and team, whatever. And then third point, leave spare time and places. You have to, it's constant stress level actually when you do pair programming because, if you program for your own, you have times where you just can relax for a few seconds and then concentrate again to code. That doesn't work when you do pair programming actually because your peer actually asks you or points you to some bug you're introduced or whatever. So it's constant stress level and you have to, introduce spare time in between and time to relax.
And communicate explicitly that it is okay and it's wanted by management.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely okay to say, I need some time. Now let's take a break.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's one additional obstacle, which in my experience is one of the biggest obstacles to pair programming in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of, silly, but it's really a big problem because many desks are L-shaped.
Yeah.
At least in Germany and wherever I've been working. And the screen and keyboard tend to sit in the corner of the L. So that you have all the big part of the desk for your papers. And this is, a pair program just does not work.
Yeah.
On a desk like that with a screen in place in the corner. So if you want to introduce pair programming, the first thing would be to move the screen and the keyboard and the mouse to a part of your desk where two people can comfortably sit beside each other, with sort of the same spatial relation to the screen, and have the keyboard can actually pass the keyboard from one to the other and have room enough for that, which is a step you actually need to actively take in most office environments that I know.
Yeah. And I think I would recommend, even if you don't do pair programming, because usually you do pair debugging at least in a normal project.
Very good point. Yeah, I've been asked to many, many desks, many screens where I sort of had to stand behind the person who asked me to help, yeah. and sort of was hard to even read what was on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, so very good point.
Just
yeah.
do this. It's a good yeah. idea for yeah. teams that work as team together.
Office environment and desk layout and placement of screen and keyboard are just different for programmers than for administrative yeah. people. So yeah, have the courage to change your desk layout.
So let's jump to the next primary practice, mm-hmm. so-called primary practice. That's called test-first programming.
Yeah, great. This is one of my personal favorites. Actually, yeah. the personal favorite I have.
Yeah, and actually, it became so important. Kent Beck wrote another book on it and said this is one of the cores, or the programming core of XP, and can be done even without XP. So you can leave out all the process stuff and the user story stuff and whatever, and still test first programming does help a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So what is test first programming? Well, very simple. It's write a test, then write the code that satisfies the test, and then refactor. But I guess we have to go a bit deeper than yeah. that.
Okay. First of all, test in this context means having a unit test.
Yeah.
Sort of using one of the frameworks, JUnit or CPP unit or NUnit. I think it's been ported to many languages as support for Python, for Ruby. Just the idea is to actually have write code that calls the code. So you write a class or a method or something, and the test is other code that calls the code you want to test, and then checks the result if they are what you want them to be. So you do not just write a class, change something, and then start the entire application, and then sort of go through the user interface and look if the behavior is what you expect it to be. I mean, that it's okay to do that, but testing in this context means having code that tests your code in a repeatable, automated way. Exactly. If you have code that you start, the code says, thumbs up, your code is good. Thumbs down, there's a bug in your code.
It's important that it's automatic. And the other thing is actually that the unit is tested. I see this a lot in projects I work done wrong, where whole subsystems are tested and the class connects to the database, mm-hmm. and you have to set up your server
right,
to get
exactly.
it. And the point is really test just the one simple single method you code right yeah. now.
Right.
Not more.
Right. But I think we're going to do an entire episode on unit testing.
Yeah.
We'll go into it's a huge area, very important stuff, very relevant. There's plenty of things to say, but we'll leave that for the other episode or otherwise.
Yeah,
run out of time now.
Yeah, but important.
Very important.
Just test the single thing you will write in the few seconds afterwards, not more.
Right, exactly.
So you code your test, and then afterwards you code your code, your business logic.
Yeah, but actually this is the sort of the pure doctrine of Kent. Mm-hmm. To say you first write the test, and then only when the test is finished, you start coding your actual code. Yes, this is a good practice, but in my personal experience, I think it doesn't make much of a difference if you sort of, I often do it in a close change. I start with a very simple mm-hmm. implementation, which I don't really put much effort into. Then I write some tests for the basic cases, and then I do them, and usually my code is not perfect, my initial code, and then I start to think about special cases, add them to the tests, look if the code does it, that sort of thing. So it's more like jumping from one to the other.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very important to first finish the test, and only when the test is finished you start actually coding. But the important thing is to actually do it more or less at the same time, because yeah. if you leave it for too late, you'll never do it.
Yeah. And I guess that's where the idea for this strict test first thing is coming from, because a lot of people, they will not write any tests when they once they've written their business logic. So
right.
That's more an philosophical or psychological problem.
Right.
I don't know.
It's sort of a way to get started, to help your own discipline. And also many people, if they first write their code, they're used to sort of manually testing it.
Mm.
And I mean, this is effort that you just don't have to do if you actually write the test.
Yeah. The other, yeah. The other important thing there is, once you write it in this way, very close to together your tests and your codes, you change, get different interfaces. But I guess we will discuss this in a test first episode, really in detail. But it changed your code. It's really a quality thing, a quality aspect here, more than just automated tests.
Exactly. Actually, that was just what I was going to say. So we actually had the same idea. Exactly. I think this is really, really important, because if you want to test your code at a fine-grained level, at the unit level, this influences your design. Yeah. It helps to actually modularize your design, because when you want to test a single class, you sort of notice that there are hidden dependencies to big other parts of the system, which in my experience usually happens if you do not do unit tests. So someone once said, test first development is a way of designing a system. And I think there's a lot of truth in it, because good testability tends to be good decoupled design. Exactly. But yeah, I think we'll leave the details of how to do this for the test driven episode. But there's one more thing about test-driven design, I think, which is relevant here, and that is you actually achieve a test suite, which is a collection of classes, sort of code that can test more or less your whole system. And this is a very valuable thing, because it gives you flexibility. Yeah. It helps you to make changes in a confident way. And which is also a basis for non-trivial refactorings.
Yeah. Actually, it's the this technique makes some of the other practices possible. Otherwise, it wouldn't work to do global code ownership and all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. So yeah, the idea is, if I change someone else's code, if I refactor code someone else wrote, and the tests afterwards still say thumbs up, everything is fine, then I can be confident that I didn't break anything. This is sort of the level of confidence you should have with this, with the tests. And so this is also an indication of the coverage you need to achieve. But just to illustrate how valuable this sort of thing can be, I once worked on a system which was, which did asynchronous communication and had a database at the back end and was highly scalable, all these sort of things. And the business requirements sort of changed quite frequently. Every couple of days, things fundamentally changed. So we had time to do really, really good coverage with the tests. And we were so confident that if a change request came in that it required a change to the database, we made the change to the database and then retested the system. And from the moment we started our work, once we had the change requirement, and the time when we were finished and said, this system is again ready for release, was about half an hour's time. And we were really confident that everything worked just fine, which was a really great way of working. It was fun. There was no pressure. There was no fear, because we felt whatever happens, we're on top of things. This is the sort of fun that test-driven development gives you.
Yeah. I've never seen a team doing real test, even unit testing in a real good way and getting back afterwards. Take care. If someone tells you unit testing doesn't work, if it is really unit testing, because I've seen it done wrong often, much too often.
Exactly. I mean, and the things you can do wrong and how to avoid them will be in the other episode.
Yeah. Maybe we should just take a few seconds to discuss the third part of test first programming, refactoring. I guess we will do another episode on this stuff, at least with the test first programming, but we have to touch it. It's very important to experience. From the core. So refactoring basically means to restructure your code without changing the behavior of the code, to call it. So you clean it up, your code, without putting new features in. So there are, I don't know, a few dozens of refactorings, so called, who describe what you do there, to rename a method, to move a method, whatever. There are dozens of them. And, the idea is actually clean up your code in this test first programming, mindset. Clean up your code after you've written it and after it works. Mm-hmm. Don't spend too much of your CPU cycles, to do it right from the first time you type your code. You have time to clean up, but clean it up as soon as possible and not someone in the future.
Yes, again, this is about courage, about quality-oriented working. If you see something that is not good, if you see something that would be better in a different way, make a note on a piece of paper beside your keyboard and fix it as soon as possible. And just to make sure there's no misunderstanding here, modern IDEs, modern development environment, have supports for refactoring. And that is great.
Yeah.
And this sort of refactoring that is supported by the IDE can be done without unit tests. Obviously, the IDE takes care of that the semantics of the code is not changed. But that is not all that there is to refactoring. Refactoring is actually at looking at things, looking how they, what would be better, how to change the design in order to make the code better. And this often goes beyond the capabilities of the IDE, just to make sure that nobody says, I'm using the Eclipse IDE, so I can do refactorings without unit tests. Sort of, yes, very small refactoring, some very small refactorings, but tests are necessary for refactorings to be confident to do things that the IDE does not automatically support.
Yeah, and to save up, to make pair programming possible, to make global code ownership possible, and stuff like that. It's not just, unit tests are not just there for making refactoring safe. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I guess we should end up the first XP episode here because, it's already very, very long episode. We didn't manage to get all our primary practices in here in the first episode. We will continue this in the second one. And, give you the rest of overview over the extreme programming development process.
Yeah. Thanks for listening in. Great to have you and hear you next time.
Thanks for listening to Software Engineering Radio. If you want to get more information about Software Engineering Radio, or if you want to give us feedback, please go to our website at se-radio.net. You can also contact the team at team@se-radio.net, although we prefer entries in our comments system on the website so other people can see what you think. Software Engineering Radio wants to thank Henning Pauli for the intro and outro music, as well as Libsyn for providing the bandwidth. This episode of SE Radio, as well as all other episodes, is licensed under Creative Commons license. See the Software Engineering Radio website for details.